Hallo.
Hey. Ups, das haben sie schon mal wieder abgeklingt. Stürzen immer welche ab, ne? Willst du die bitte an oder bist du darüber hin?
Das ist besonders gern. Oder mich nicht so.
Danke.
Ja. It was like people were having a lot of fun.
Oh, scheiße.
Good evening, Venerable Phil. Good morning, Venerable Phil.
Good morning and good evening to you.
Good morning.
How's everybody?
A little bit of Christmas stress.
Yes. Okay. Well, we're charging along with the proof of future lives. We covered six proofs for the mind's cause in the last class. So today we're going to continue through proof seven. I think there are 10 of them, so 7 through 10. So here's proof number 7. Consider the four elements which are the basis of the sense powers, meaning the living tissue. They are not the material cause of the mind because you can damage the sense powers and don't usually damage the mind. Now, there's a expression in Tibetan called fat and happy. We have it in English, too. And that refers to a healthy person. And a good mind is referred to with the same expression, fat and happy. Now, Master Dharmakirti's argument here is that if, as the Charvakas claim, the mind is somehow dependent on the sense powers or on the elements, you know, like in chemicals, that if you damage those, you should damage your mind too. But this doesn't usually happen. We can look at the example of Helen Keller, who, lacking the sense powers of sight and hearing, became a successful author and lecturer, and political activist as well. So, and there's also a story of a great bodhisattva in ancient India who was walking along a road toward Nalanda Monastery when a demon confronted him and asked for his eye, which he said, the demon said, he really needed. And the bodhisattva reached up with his finger and plucked out one of his eyes and gave it to the demon. And the demon then threw it on the ground and stomped on it. And the bodhisattva almost lost his bodhicitta at that point, but he didn't. When he got to the monastery where he lived, the monks kidded him about only having one eye, and he would reply that, with my one eye, I see more scripture than you do with two eyes. Now, the reason this story is used as an example of that proof is that this bodhisattva's mind didn't even become distressed due to losing an eye, meaning losing the living tissue. The living tissue was damaged. Well, it was lost. But it didn't distress his mind. Now, we can look at our own experience with a loss or damaging of sense powers. You know, the simple one is that when one of our limbs, like, goes to sleep, due to impaired circulation. It doesn't damage your mind. You know, you sit down to meditate and you're there for a while and you realize when you're done that one of your legs is asleep or both of your legs are asleep, but it hasn't damaged your mind at all. The living tissue that is our tactile sense power in that limb temporarily does not work. But we still have our mind, you know, it's undamaged. And toward the end of people's lives, you know, they may lose hearing sense power or eye sense power and so on. But their minds still work. Or consider a woman who has just given birth. You know, they've been in labor for hours with great pain, you know, great damage to their tactile sense powers. But they are happy, you know, beaming, extremely pleased, you know, when they give birth to their child. Their mind is not damaged. Now, by the way, we, as normal people, are not allowed to do something as drastic as plucking out one of our eyes, unless we're very high-level bodhisattvas. The reason is that we might regret it later, and regretting a good deed turns into a very powerful bad deed. We might, for example, give away all of our money, you know, and that's a good deed. And then 3 days later regret it, you know, turning that gift, that giving, that good deed into a very bad deed. Now, a high-level bodhisattva has removed attachment from their mind stream, you know, and they will not later regret an act, such as plucking out an eyeball or cutting off an arm. Now, along these lines, we have the story of a previous incarnation of Lord Buddha, who, coming upon a starving tigress and her cubs, offered them his body. And the tigress was so weak, she couldn't even take a part of his body. So this bodhisattva cut open his arm so she could drink his blood, which gave her strength to then use his body and offer some of it to her cubs. Now, the cubs in a later incarnation were the five ascetics that Lord Buddha spent time with just before he became enlightened. A high-level bodhisattva is overjoyed when someone asks her for something, you know. To be able to give something to someone who wants it produces joy in that bodhisattva, and it doesn't matter if that something is part of the bodhisattva's body. Now, about this proof, the mind does not come from the sense powers, because there are instances where there are no sense powers, or the sense powers are lost, and the mind is not damaged. For something to be a material cause, it must always produce its result. Or if the mind is the result of the sense powers, then if the sense powers are damaged, there must always be a corresponding damage to the mind. And that's the Charvaka's claim. But this simply is not so. So, proof number 8. Consider the main mind. The mind is the basis of the sense powers because it projects them. Now, Master Dharmakirti goes on to say that not only are the sense powers not the material cause of the mind is the basis of the sense powers. Master Dharmakirti says this, you know. Note that he uses the term basis and not cause. The sense powers in some way depend on the rest of your mind. So, in the Wheel of Life, the second link is represented by a potter making pots. There are many translations of what this is. But it is immature karma, or karma that is not ripened. So this is the karma you do all during your life. You know, it's the gathering of karma. Hold on just a second. I've got somebody at the door. What time?
12 o'clock.
Okay. Sorry about that. So the second link is often translated as immature karma. This is karma that is not ripened. And this is the karma that you do all during your life. You know, it's the gathering of karma. Then the tenth link is represented by a pregnant woman. And that refers to ripe karma, another kind of karma. And that karma in the tenth link is your mind. You know, it's the result of immature karma. And it is what we call projecting karma. Because it results in a particular kind of rebirth, or more specifically, your mind in a particular kind of rebirth. Remember in the karma course where we talked about what being a dog or being a human really meant? You know, that being a dog means, or having the perceptions of a dog, and being a human means having the perceptions of a human, and so on. So this 10th link is really the kind of perceptions that we have, which is our mind. Is this object that you might be holding in front of you, is it a pen or is it a chew toy? You know, the way we perceive the object is dependent upon this projecting karma. Now, the connection between link 2, which is immature karma, and link 10, which is ripe karma, is links 8 and 9, which are types of desire that occur as you die. And they trigger the immature karma into becoming ripe karma. We'll talk more about this in the next class. So these are important things to learn, especially if you want to get out of the cycle of rebirths. So in that sense, the mind, you know, which is ripening karma, determines the kind of rebirth that you have. And that rebirth contains the sense powers. So the mind is not the material cause of the sense powers, but it does determine the kind of sense powers you will have. You know, and this is an example of how we think about material causes and conditions. You know, these are the things that slip over into something similar, destroying themselves in the process. And there are things that act as conditions for something else happening. Now, Master Dharmakirti here is probably overstating his case by saying that the mind is the basis of the sense powers. Now, his intention is to shock the Charvakas, who hold the sense powers are the material cause of the mind. And he includes the opposite argument in this proof to them. You know, he offers no proof that the mind is the cause of the sense powers. He uses the word basis instead of cause, you know. But the effect on the Charvakas must have been very, very drastic. So, proof number 9. Consider the mind. It is the cause of the mind to stay, because what keeps the mind going is the mental karma from the past. So the question here is, why does the mind stick around, you know? Then we get to, why does it appear to disappear? You know, why do old people continue to live, and why do young people die? Why do some people die in the healthy state, and some people die in a very unhealthy state? You know, what's the reason for this? What are the causes? Now remember, as we address these questions, that for something to be the cause, it must always be a cause, meaning it always brings its result. Now, coming after the previous proof, where Master Dharmakirti says that mind, which is mental karma, provides the basis of life, of a rebirth, and so on. We were talking about that in the previous proof. So when the mental karma for that life runs out, the body and sense powers, meaning the living tissue, of that life stops. Now note that Master Dharmakirti uses the term mental karma here because he wants to prove that mind causes mind. The thing we're trying to do is to replace an ingrained idea that we have only a single existence by proving to ourselves that the mind keeps on going. We're trying to replace this learned thing that we have, you know, which for many of us may be an innate view due to similar thinking in many past lives. We're trying to replace that with an innate view, meaning hardwired view, you know, that the mind goes on after death of the body and by extension extends backwards forever and will continue forever also. So his statement, you know, consider the mind. It is the cause of the mind to stay because what keeps the mind going is the mental karma from the past. So he's saying that we have the cause of a mind is a previous mind. And he's going beyond this. We've been saying that the cause of mind is a previous moment of mind, right? But now he's extending this to say that the cause of, say, the mind of this life is a previous mental karma, which would be the mental, you know, what we've done in past lives to get the mind of this life. So we go now to proof number 10. Consider the mind of a normal person at the moment of death. It does cross the line into a similar state of mind in the next life because it possesses desire at the time of death. Now, normal person here means someone who is not a foe destroyer or an arhat. The foe destroyer is one who has eliminated all obstacles to liberation, meaning that they have eliminated desire. And according to the teaching of the Wheel of Life, they are not forced into another samsaric rebirth or into another suffering kind of rebirth. We will discuss the nature of the desire that causes samsaric rebirth in the next class. Now, there are lots of kinds of desire, and not all of them are the kind that we're talking about here. Now, as it's what we are considering here, though, is a particular state of mind that we have at the time of death that projects our mind into another rebirth. Now, Master Dharmakirti has moved from talking about what are and are not causes of mind to proving that the mind continues into a next life. Now, these proofs may seem simple to us in the sense that both, in the sense of both being obvious and not really having logical proofs. Now, we have to examine these proofs thoroughly and carefully in order to understand their profound nature. All Buddhist schools accept Dharmakirti's presentation of logic and its proofs, you know, both the Hinayana school and the Mahayana schools accept those proofs. So these proofs are not one Buddhist school against another. And as we pointed out at the beginning of the course, Master Dharmakirti is debating specifically with the Hindu school, and this school was called the Charvakas. If some of the proofs seem flimsy against what we think a Charvaka might accept, we have to consider that they must have worked, or else Master Dharma Kirti wouldn't have used them. One of his own rules of debate is that you cannot offer as a proof something that the other party cannot accept. So, you know, we will cover what constitutes a valid proof in Course 13, the Art of Logic. But for now, a valid proof is something where the person accepts the truth of various parts of a proof, but had never put together the relation between the parts before, and that the reason is the link between the subject and the predicate. So, what's an example? Consider sound. It is a changing thing because it is produced. Now, there may be someone who thinks that sound is an unchanging phenomenon, but they do understand what a changing thing is, and they do understand that because something is produced, it is a changing thing. But they haven't understood those properties with relation to sound. So providing this statement of proof to them will force them to accept that sound is a changing thing. And by force them to accept, what we mean is, ah, I get it. You know, that's the thing. Consider sound. It is a changing thing because it is produced. So we say consider sound to a person who thinks that sound is unchanging. It is a changing thing. They understand what a changing thing is because it, sound, is produced. And they understand that sound is produced. You know, all you have to do is ring a bell in front of such a person, and they understand that that bell sound is produced. And then they get it that sound is a changing thing, that it isn't like they previously thought it's an unchanging thing. It's a changing thing, and they get it now. Now, if they don't accept the fact that changing things are produced things, or they don't understand the difference between changing things and unchanging things, then this proof is invalid for that person, and you cannot offer it to them. Similarly, if a person already understands that sound is a changing thing, then this logical statement is not valid for them either, and you can't offer it to them. And these are the rules of logic that Master Dharmakirti set up. So by him offering these proofs to the Charvakas, he understood what they did know about mind and what they didn't know about mind and what they could accept. And he listed these proofs, all 10 of them. So if we are puzzled by some of these proofs, then we have to dig deeper. And that may take a while, but we have to do it if we want to leave the suffering life, if we want to leave samsara behind. So what the point of all of these proofs is to get us to understand deeply that the mind does not stop at death. That we had a mind before the moment of our conception. And that mind continues on and on and on and on. And it has always been. And if we don't accept that, then there's no particular reason that we need to study Buddhism at all. If we don't accept past and future lives, then what we do in this life has no impact beyond what might happen to us in this life at all. It's not going to determine what happens to us in the future, because there really is no future as far as our mind is concerned. So that's a brief, hopefully helpful explanation of the final four proofs that Master Dharmakirti gave to the Charvakas. So now's a good time for questions, if you have any.
Yes, I have one regarding proof number 8. He's choosing his words very carefully. And in the class notes, it stated, let's consider the main mind.
Yes.
Does this refer to one of the three categories of the mind we discussed in a former class, the gross mind, the subtle mind, and the very subtle mind, or?
It's talking about the gross mind, but the gross mind, this, let's say our awareness, when we think, when we're aware of things, that's the gross mind. But the gross mind is divided into, well, for now we can say two parts. There's the main mind, and then there are the mental factors. The main mind has just a very kind of general, fuzzy awareness of an object. And it's the details about the object, whether we think it's good or bad, for example, whether we think it's nice or unpleasant, things like that. Those details are provided to us by what we call the mental factors. The mental factors are a huge study in and of themselves. We don't go into them too much. But there are factors that, for example, move the mind toward an object. There are factors that make us do bad things regarding an object, and there are factors that make us do good things regarding an object, good thoughts. So the mental factors are the things that kind of fill out the object. The main mind itself is this very kind of general but fuzzy awareness of an object. Does that help? No.
But then I don't get, because the last line is because it projects them.
Oh.
And we learn that the mind who is moving from life to life is the very subtle mind.
Yes. That is true. At the point of death, or a few minutes, maybe even a few seconds before death, all the seeds that have been generated but have not been, that have been generated during that life but have not ripened, they ripen.
Mm-hmm.
And what those provide is your next rebirth, like where it's going to be.
Yeah.
Okay, animal, human, hell realm, God, whatever it is. And the environmental factors that go along with that. Like you're born a human and you're born wealthy, or you're born a human and you're born in a country where there's war all the time. Things like that. Or you're born blind. So it is that mind, the karma of that mind that all of a sudden ripened, that provide a rebirth. And that rebirth is actually your mind of the next life, your perceptions.
Okay. Okay.
All right.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah. Anybody else? Well, good. I'm glad you all understand this perfectly. And you could discuss it in your discussion groups.
Yeah. Then thank you so much, Venerable Phil.
You're very welcome.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Pleasant Christmas shopping. Try to keep a balanced mind.
Yes.
While you're doing this.
Difficult.
Yeah. We try our very, very best.
Yeah. Deshi Michael finally told his family, this was in his mid-20s, I think, that he was no longer going to be giving them Christmas presents or birthday presents or anything like that. That it affected his mind too much. And he said, this doesn't mean I don't love you, but I'm just not going to do any Christmas present shopping for you anymore.
Yeah.
So that's something to think about.
Thank you.
You probably won't get away with it if you were to tell your family and friends that.
You can try.
Yeah.
But we should make people happy. So when I go to Christmas party without a present for my niece, I think you won't be happy.
Yeah, right. So while you're doing the shopping, just keep in mind, you know, that you're doing this for the benefit of other people.
Okay, that's good. Great.
Yes, we will do. Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
See you next week.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
See you next week. Bye.